All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Gaitis, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Clary, the Honorable Theodora Gaitis presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. I'd like to welcome you all to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'd also like to welcome our student observers today as well. Today is November 8th, 2023, and we have five cases on our calendar. Three of those cases are scheduled for oral argument this morning. And just a few notes before we move into our first argument of the day. Oral arguments are now being shown live on the Zoom platform, even the ones that are in the courtroom. The argument this morning is being recorded also. It's just an audio recording. And that audio recording will be available on our website shortly. Parties, it looks like you are ready to go with the first case on our calendar, so I'll call that case and we'll turn things over to you. The first case on our calendar this morning is Great Northwest Insurance Company Appellant versus Hector A. Campbell Respondent and Betty L. Campbell. And the case number is A230519. Just a couple of ground rules. You'll be making your arguments at the lectern here this morning. Each side will have 15 minutes to present their arguments. The time will be counted down on the clock that is on the lectern. And appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal argument, and you don't have to request that in the beginning. You can see how things go and make a decision on the fly. The lectern is adjustable, so please feel free to get comfortable before you begin your arguments. That concludes my remarks. I will now hand things over to the attorneys with counsel for the appellant going first. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Chris Wills, and I represent the appellant Great Northwest Insurance Company. Great Northwest respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court's decision as to the roof damage limitation endorsement and affirm the district court's decision on the overhead and profit endorsement. I'm going to start first by talking about the roof damage limitation endorsement, and then I'll move over to the overhead and profit endorsement. But before I do that, I want to remark on some facts that were undisputed before the district court, because I think it's really important in understanding what the undisputed facts were to understand the positions that we're advocating today. So before the district court, there was no dispute that the shingles on the Campbell's roof were damaged in a May 2022 storm. There was also no dispute before the district court that the decking or the wood underlayment that's beneath those shingles was not damaged in that May 2022 storm. There was no dispute before the district court that when the Campbell's contractor, Greatstone, removed the shingles from the roof, that there were gaps in the decking board that were discovered. There was no dispute that those gaps pre-existed the storm. There was no dispute that the state building code does not allow new shingles to be put on those decking boards because of the gaps. And finally, there was no dispute that the insurance policy that Great Northwest issued to the Campbells was a replacement cost policy. So understanding those facts, the first issue that I'd like to get to is the roof damage limitation endorsement, and that endorsement unambiguously excludes coverage for the new sheathing or plywood or deck boards that were put on. So that endorsement provides that Great Northwest will only pay for direct physical loss or damage to the outermost layer of roof material, and that there's no coverage for tear-off, repair, removal, or replacement of any layer of roofing material, including decking, beneath the outermost damaged layer. I think either way that the court looks at it, the new sheathing or OSB or plywood that goes onto that deck was either a repair or a replacement. So you could either...
Counsel, what would happen if the if the contractor just put on the shingles and ignored the code.
Sure, and Your Honor, I think what you're getting to is the second point that I was going to talk about in terms of the endorsement, which is whether that violates the statute. But to directly answer your question, they couldn't put those shingles on consistent with the code. They couldn't get a permit from the city to do that.
So it would be impossible to do that. And I think the court in its findings indicated the distinguish between St. Matthew's Church and suggested that that there's a connection between the decking and the replacement that wasn't present in St. Matthew's, and that installation instructions provided that they had to be done at the same time.
Yeah, and respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with the district court's conclusion in that regard. If we look at the St. Matthew's opinion in terms of the difference between the drywall and the difference between the shingles in this case, there's no discernible difference in terms of what the code required. In the St. Matthew's case, what the contractor was proposing to do is, after they had removed the drywall from the masonry wall, these cracks are discovered, and the building inspector comes out and says, look, you can't put the drywall back on with these cracks still there. That would violate the building code. Now, the contractor in that case, in the St. Matthew's case, had intended to do exactly that. And the Supreme Court, in its opinion, commented that the only thing standing between the contractor and putting that new the new drywall on the old masonry wall was this code issue. So they could have done it, but the code issue prevented them from doing it. They couldn't get the permit. And that's exactly what we have in this case, Your Honor. If you look at Greatstone's initial estimate, Greatstone, the contractor, intended to put these shingles right over the old decking boards. And there's no dispute in this.
In the Supreme Court's opinion, I mean, they specifically say, in other words, viewing the project from the perspective of a drywall installer, there was nothing in the condition of the masonry that prevented the installation of new drywall. But that's, I mean, the district court here distinguished that and said, well, they couldn't put the shingles on the existing decking with the gap. So why was the district court wrong?
Yeah, and respectfully, Your Honor, I think with I used that same phrase in my brief and just turned it around in terms of what was happening in this case. That from the perspective of a roofer, there was nothing that was stopping them from putting these shingles on. They could have put the shingles on, and there was no dispute before the district court that, well, you know, from a factual basis, that because these gaps exist, the shingles can't go on.
But you could hypothesize, well, the drywall wouldn't have failed in the church. And here, the shingles, it sounds like, you know, you're acknowledging would have failed because of the gaps.
Yeah, and I'm not, Your Honor. I think what we're... I think the issue that we're talking about is exactly the same in the two cases, in that there's no evidence in the St. Matthew's case, at least there's no discussion in the opinion, that if the drywall is put on this masonry wall with the cracks in the masonry wall, that the drywall is all of a sudden going to fail, or that there's going to be water that gets on it, or any other issue that's going to happen. And we have the exact same scenario in this case.
Counsel, I'm going to go back to what you just said in answer to the question from Judge Siegel. I thought you told me that they couldn't put on the shingles.
Your Honor,
they couldn't. They couldn't get a permit.
And that's my point, Your Honor. There was nothing other than the code issue that prevented them from putting the shingles on. So there's no evidence in this case. And if you look at the affidavit that Mr. Williamson signed, he doesn't say, From a roofing contractor's perspective, we can't put shingles onto this decking board with the gaps there, other than the fact that it's not code compliant.
Okay, now.
Sorry. That brings us right to the statute, 65A.10, which pretty clearly requires that when property is replaced, rebuilt, or repaired, it has to be done so in accordance with minimum code. So how would putting the shingles on the decking here that, you know, violated code comply with the statute?
Sure. So, Your Honor, I think what we have to do is go to the second sentence of that subdivision, which says when we're dealing with a partial loss, and it's undisputed that that's what we have here. We don't have a total loss to the building. We have a partial loss. Then that coverage, the minimum code coverage, only applies to that portion of the property that is damaged. And in the St. Matthews case, what the Supreme Court said is that essentially that second sentence on the partial loss means what it says, and that it only requires the insurance company to bring that part of the property that was damaged by the insured event up to the minimum code. And here, the damaged portion of the property is the shingle, not the decking.
But in St. Matthews, they also said it was a fact-intensive inquiry. And one of the distinguishing factors to the district court here was that these are roof assemblies, in the sense that the deck and the shingles are a single unit, unlike St. Matthews.
And, Your Honor, I think if you look at it, so you're correct in terms of what the Supreme Court said, that it was a fact-intensive inquiry. But if we look at the facts that the Supreme Court analyzed in performing its fact-intensive inquiry and rejecting the contention from the church that the masonry wall and the drywall were part of one item, which is the wall, and we compare that to the decking and the sheathing and the argument that those are part of one item, the roofing assembly, we see that all three of the facts that the Minnesota Supreme Court identified are present here with the decking and with the shingles. So, for example, the Supreme Court said that there was no dispute in the St. Matthews case that State Farm covers the cost of replacing the drywall consistent with any municipal code. And the example that they gave there is they said, well, look, the statute would certainly require that if the building contractor or the building inspector comes in and says we have damaged drywall, but not all the drywall is damaged, and the undamaged drywall is only half-inch drywall, and the building code requires 5/8-inch drywall. The Supreme Court said in that instance, then the statute would require State Farm to replace all the drywall all around the building. And that's exactly what we have here. There's
well,
no...
Can I interrupt you for 1 second? What do we do with the fact that the manufacturer of the shingles said the shingles can't be installed on decking that has more than an 1/8-inch gap in it? So literally, the instructions are you need less than, you can't have a 1/4-inch gap. So that seems to be how do you deal with that fact?
The same way that the Supreme Court dealt with it in St. Matthews, you have a...
No, that seems like a distinguishing fact to me. I didn't see any facts in St. Matthews saying you can't install drywall if there happens to be any cracks behind it. I mean, drywall is used, all the time to cover up cracks. I mean, I don't know.
And, Your Honor, I would view it exactly the same as the Supreme Court did in St. Matthews. In that case, you have a municipal building inspector who's standing there who's saying, look, the code doesn't allow you. The code does not allow you to put this drywall on this masonry wall while the cracks exist. So before you do that, you have to repair the cracks in the masonry wall.
But again, I think to Judge Siegel's point, this was more than just a code problem. In St. Matthews, the majority said there was nothing in the condition of the masonry that prevented the installation of new drywall. Here, we have the shingle manufacturer saying you can't have these kind of gaps in the decking and install these shingles. So I see that as really a distinction between this situation and the St. Matthews case.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. And I'd point you specifically back to we're still dealing with a code violation issue in both cases. So in the St. Matthews case, we have the building inspector saying you can't put this drywall up with these cracks in the masonry wall. And in this case, we have the exact same thing. The building inspector saying, look, the state building code does not allow you to put the shingles on this roof when these gaps exist in the decking boards, so you have to repair them. To your point, and I think maybe this is a distinction that I'm failing to properly make and explain to the court, there's nothing in the installation instructions that says, look, from an installation standpoint, is you're standing there on the roof and you pull out a shingle and you want to nail it into the decking boards, that you can't nail it into the decking boards if there's a gap of more than an eighth of an inch. It simply says we recommend that there not be those gaps of more than an eighth of an inch because of the potential that the product would, you know, fail or that you would potentially have leaks.
As the insurer, would seem to be something you would not want to happen, right?
Well, I can't comment on what the insurance company would or wouldn't want to have happen. But I think the distinction in this, how the two cases are alike, is that there is nothing from the contractor's perspective that's standing in the way of the repair occurring other than the code violation. And that's how I would compare the two cases. And to turn the phrase that you pointed out, Judge Siegel, is the court said in St. Matthews, viewing the project from the perspective of a roofer, as they intended to start the project, and as the roofing contractor is standing on the roof, there's nothing in the condition of the old decking boards that prevents the installation of the new shingles other than the code compliance issue. So it's exactly the same. In terms of the second fact, so that's the third fact that the court identified that they said, well, this is why you can't treat the masonry wall and the drywall the same. The second fact that they looked at, and we've already talked about the first one, the second fact was that the damage to the masonry wall was not caused by the insured event. And if we look here, the damage to the decking boards was obviously not caused by the same insured event. The gaps in those decking boards likely existed for years before Great Northwest ever insured the property. So I think as the court does the fact-intensive inquiry in this case and looks at the three facts that the Supreme Court identified in the St. Matthews case, it will see that all three of those facts are also present in this case, making the two cases indistinguishable and meaning that we can't simply look at the decking and the shingles and say, well, that's part of one item, that one item being the roofing assembly. In conclusion, I've only got 30 seconds left. There's no way I'm going to have time to talk about overhead and profit. So I'll just wrap up by asking that the court reverse the district court on the roof damage limitation endorsement and then affirm the district court on the overhead and profit endorsement. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Wills.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. Yes, the St. Matthews case does turn
on... Do you identify yourself for the record that we are making, please?
I'm sorry.
Sorry to interrupt your flow.
Edward Beckman for the respondents, Hector and Betty Campbell. Pardon me. St. Matthews does indeed turn on viewing the repair job from the perspective of the contractor. And from the perspective of this roof installer cannot nail shingles to inappropriate decking. So say the manufacturer install instructions, which receive are under color of the building codes. The building codes require we honor manufacturer install instructions, and according to this manufacturer, this product is ineffectual without a proper surface. And so Minnesota Statute 65A10 does apply because you cannot repair the shingles without doing this work as well. And I would also like to point the court to a separate argument beyond the statute that under the four corners of this policy, this exclusion is not triggered because the OSB board is not replacing anything. It's new install. It's being installed on top. And therefore, under the terms of this exclusion, it's not triggered because the exclusion itself only is triggered when you're replacing something. So what the insurance company is attempting to do is to distinguish materials used to do the repair, and that's not proper under the terms of their contract. Now, that's just a contract law analysis and has nothing to do with the statutory analysis, which I think has been well argued. So
I noted that appellant was very careful to use the word repair. And is it your position that for the purpose of the policy language, putting that OSB on top of the decking is not a repair of the decking?
That's correct, because we're not altering the existing decking. This is an overlay on that, and that's necessary for the shingles. It would be different if we were pulling up some decking and replacing it, but the facts of this case are this is applied on top, and that's important for the contract law argument.
And it's your position that that does not constitute a repair?
True.
Okay, thanks.
Council, doesn't that raise questions, though, that insurance company is now paying for a new installation? Generally, you insure something. If it's defective or gets damaged, it's repaired. But now you're talking about a new installation?
I don't think that raises an issue because it's just one of the materials needed to do the shingles, as opposed to other layers underneath that do not have to be addressed in order to repair the shingles. And I'd also add that under this contract law analysis, exclusions are always strictly construed against the insurance company that wrote it. So they know how to write these policies in a way that signals their intent. So under contract law analysis, the exclusion is not triggered. Again, that's completely separate than the statutory argument. Returning to the statutory argument, but for the profit and overhead, the St. Matthews case, both the majority opinion and its footnote number 6, specifically states that it is triggered by replacement cost value coverage. And that is what the four corners of the statute says. When there is replacement cost coverage in a policy, this statute applies. And there is no qualification to that. St. Matthews arises from wind and hail. Footnote 6, where there's a discussion about what if the building codes required copper wiring to replace aluminum wiring. Again, that arises from a storm. And this is a storm. So,
But wasn't there an exclusion for unless it was a result of fire or lightning here?
Yes, and that is not appropriate because the statute applies to any replacement cost value policy. So it's not the the event that triggers it. It's the trigger of application of the statute is actually just writing the policy. When a policy is written for buildings and replacement cost coverage, then the statute applies, no matter what the peril is underneath it.
Well, your opponent didn't get a chance to address this yet, but I think in the briefs they're arguing that lead to an absurd result, in that almost anything would involve profit and overhead then would be covered when you're interpreting it that way.
Yes, and as I put in the reply brief, I think the result here is that appraisal panels per 65A01 subdivision 3, the legislature has determined that that's the forum to prevent an absurd result. If there's going to be an absurd argument about having to pay for ice cream for the contractors or what have you, appraisal panels are well equipped to deal with an absurd result, factually speaking. But I think here, what we're here today to do is to understand the full scope of the application of the statute, not the underlying facts of it. And this statute absolutely applies to any replacement cost value policy that is on real property without qualification. The statute does not qualify any given cost. If the legislature intended to say, no, we're going to preclude ice cream for the contractors or we're going to preclude overhead and profit, it would say so. But the statute is unqualified, and that must be the result here. Now, in terms of absurd valuations, which is Your Honor's concern and this insurance company's concern, appraisal panels are well equipped to resolve the factual disputes about what is appropriate and not appropriate. And that also is contained in 65A26, which is an appraisal clause specific to hail claims. And of course, 65A01 subdivision 3 applies to any policy that encompasses the peril of fire. So we have a forum to prevent those absurd results. That's my point.
In light of the St. Matthews Church case, is the result you're looking for here, or that you're defending, I guess, entirely dependent on a court concluding that the decking, the OSB, you know, the stuff under the shingles, and the shingles themselves are one unified piece of property.
No, that is one argument that we have, and I can get into that, but no. And the reason why is those manufacturer install instructions for the shingles. In order to do the shingles, you need proper foundation, I'll call it. You need that OSB, or you need a flat surface, just as the district court noted on page 14. And so I think that that is a little bit different fact scenario than thinking of the roof assembly as one unit. So no, I don't think our position is dependent upon that, but I would encourage the court to agree with the district court that a roof assembly is one thing under Chapter 9 of the Building Codes. It is one thing to the Department of Labor and Industry, as the district court properly noted. And just intuitively, shingles are going to sit there on the ground and be useless unless it's applied to a proper surface, so says the manufacturer. I mean, if we take their position to an absurd length, then apparently a caulk gun used for the shingles is not covered either. We just can't segregate out all of these different materials and all these different expenses like that and honor the statute. The statute is triggered with, and this is, the statute is triggered for all property that is damaged. And so when we address all property that's damaged, we can't segregate out all these materials. There's no basis in the law for that. There's no basis in the statute for that. And it's just unworkable. So we need to understand that the damaged shingles are property that was damaged, and all the materials required to address that are covered by the statute. So I will not reiterate my briefing. I think I've touched on the points that I've wanted to make, and I would yield the balance of my time to counsel unless the court has any further questions.
Doesn't look like it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'll start at the overhead and profit issue and then circle back around to the language on the roof damage limitation endorsement. In terms of the overhead and profit endorsement, the Campbell's primary argument is that it violates the statute 65A.10. And the argument that you heard again today is that if you have any project where there's any property that's damaged and it has to be brought up to code compliance, then the insurance company is automatically required under the statute to pay for any charge that the insured's contractor levels, regardless of what it is, because that statute applies. And that's simply not what the statute requires. A plain reading of the statute is that the insurer is only required to pay for increased costs that are necessitated by having to bring a damaged item into compliance with the building code. And issues related to overhead and profit simply have nothing to do with that.
So if a contractor, wrote out the estimate and included its overhead and profit, I mean, which is reasonable, you're not going to work for free, in the actual labor costs, I mean, would the insurance company then pay it? Is it that it was separated out?
Yeah, and
I'm not really all that familiar with the construction industry, but it appears that that's standard in the industry to separate it out. But if they included it, where would we be?
So certainly, nobody is asking, and I saw this show up a little bit in the briefing, that, you know, the contractor's being asked to work for free here, and nobody's requiring that, right? We get invoices that come out that say, here's what the labor was, here's what the material was, and those charges are paid regularly and consistently. The issue is when you have a separate line item that's just listed out at the bottom of the invoice that says, here, I'm going to, in addition to all these other charges, I'm going to tack on 10% for overhead, and I'm going to tack on 10% for my profit in this case. And so to answer your question more specifically, Your Honor, I think if the contractor has increased costs that are necessitated specifically by the code compliance issue, so for example, we have to now, the contractor goes out, looks at the shingles on the roof, and the building inspector comes out and says, look, I realize that you can replace only some of those shingles, but you got to replace them all because, you know, the shingles are red and the building code now requires brown shingles. Then obviously Great Northwest has to pay for that. And the increased costs associated with it, including additional nails and additional shingles and new ice paper and all that stuff. But to say, okay, well, now you have to pay for any additional charge just because you have a code compliance issue, I don't think that's what the statute requires. In terms of the roof damage limitation endorsement and the policy language itself, I kind of started on this earlier, but I think the court can look at what happened here with the new sheathing is either a repair or a replacement. You could say that the gaps in the old decking, to your point, Judge Cleary, were repaired with new OSB or plywood going over those gaps and eliminating them, or you could say that the old decking surface was replaced with this new plywood because that's what the new plywood is there to do. It's to provide that new surface to nail the shingles into. The argument that Mr. Beckman made as to, well, there has to be tear-off or there has to be removal, just ignores the plain language of the endorsement, which uses the disjunctive or and says that you can have tear-off, removal, repair, or replacement. And since you can describe what happened with the new sheathing is either repair or replacement, the endorsement would apply and bar coverage. On the issues of the endorsement violating the statute, I think that's been well argued. So unless the court has any additional questions for me, I'll yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. That concludes the first argument on our calendar.